And we are back to the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch for Tuesday, April 22nd. For the Virginia Voice, your readers are Lindsay Ryland and Fred Danz.
Welcome back. We're on the opinion page, and an opinion piece by Eric Terry, who is president of the Virginia Restaurant, Lodging, and Travel Association. And the title of his piece is A Commentary, Overtaxing Struggling Restaurants Hurts All of Us. Have you ever been out to your favorite restaurant lately? Do you go there as often as you used to? Do you notice that there were fewer people there the last time that you went? The operators of your favorite restaurant have certainly noticed. Restaurants across the Commonwealth are facing a critical moment. Cost increases for restaurants combined with economically exhausted customers have put the squeeze on Virginia's hospitality sector. Making matters worse, we've seen more and more Virginia localities turn to increased prepared food taxes, commonly called meals taxes, that cost customers and restaurants alike. Meals taxes make the decisions to eat out a harder one, and the biggest impact is often felt by those who need help most. Together, Virginia's restaurateurs are hoping to persuade our local public servants to give their constituents, including our servers and customers, a break. Nationwide, the National Restaurant Association calculates that the average profit margin for a full-service restaurant is between 3 and 5%. Many of the Commonwealth's localities impose meal taxes of 4%, 6%, or more, and they can be as high as 10%. Essentially, this means that when you pay your tab in a town, city, or county with a meals tax, the local government is likely netting as much or more money than the restaurant. On top of that, restaurants are actually having to pay for the responsibility to remit these taxes in the form of credit card interchange fees that apply to the transactions and the remittances in many cases. When hard economic times hit consumers, eating out is one of the first parts of the average household budget to go. It's becoming disturbingly clear that consumers are feeling pressured into making those hard choices. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index has been declining for four consecutive months. In March, it settled at its lowest level since January 2021. Credit card delinquencies are continuing to rise sharply, and household savings continue to dwindle, as noted by the Federal Reserve. All of that observation points to one conclusion. Restaurant sales are in for a bumpy 2025, no matter what. That pressure from the customer's side of the counter is compounded by the hard economic outlook that restaurants face from an operations standpoint. The National Restaurant Association estimates that the restaurant industry shed 25,500 jobs in the first quarter of 2025, the worst three-month period since the fourth quarter of 2020. Wholesale food prices are up nearly 10% year over year and up 3.5% just from January to February. Actual restaurant sales declined 1.5% from January to February, and are down 2.1% compared to February of 2024, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. When the March numbers are released, we expect they will have fallen even further. The numbers show that business is slowing at a dangerous rate. For a local board of supervisors or city or town council to add an arbitrary percentage on top of as a tax on consumers does nothing but hurt business even more. Efforts to increase meal taxes often include arguments like, well, there are meals taxes in many localities and there are still restaurants there, so it can't be that bad. These arguments disregard that even by the most conservative estimates, 20% of restaurants fail within their first year. A much greater proportion, nearly half of these estimates, fail within the first 5 years. Restaurants, as a business model, are blessed to be welcome in all corners of our communities, but ours are ours are among the most labor-intensive and cost-intensive businesses to run. And what may seem like a small, reasonable tax increase to your local supervisor or controller can be the nail in the coffin for a number of small businesses in your community. Restaurants are centers of employment, employing over 378,000 people here in Virginia alone. We are great contributors to local and state tax revenues, contributing $5.7 billion in taxes annually. But beyond those numbers, we're part of what makes our community feel like home. So on behalf of the operator of your favorite restaurant, we're hoping to see you soon. And we're hoping that the public service in Virginia localities can give restaurants and our customers a bit of a break. And that was an opinion piece, by Eric Terry. Overtaxing struggling restaurants hurts us all.
Next on the opinions page, a piece by Glenn Davis. Glenn Davis is director of the Virginia Department of Energy. The title of his piece today is Youngkin Isn't the One Killing Clean Energy. I read Blair St. Ledger Olson's recent column, Governor Youngkin Pulls Plug on Clean Energy Progress, from April 15th, with growing frustration. Her claims about Governor Glenn Youngkin pulling the plug on clean energy fundamentally misrepresent the governor's recent legislative decisions and miss the mark on what's at stake for Virginia's energy future. Let's be honest about what's really going on. In 2020, Governor Ralph Northam signed the Virginia Clean Economy Act, VCEA, a bill supported by the Virginia League of Conservation Voters, LCV, where Blair now serves as Director of Advocacy and Campaigns, into law, committing Virginia to an unachievable mandate to build a net-zero power sector through solar and wind expansion. At the time, Virginia had flat economic growth, with projections showing energy demand increasing by just 1 to 2% annually. Just 5 years later, Virginia is experiencing the fastest annual growth in energy demand since World War II, at 6.5%, stemming from successes in our technology and advanced manufacturing sectors, along with the most in-state migration we've seen in 10 years. Energy demand is projected to more than double in the next decade. Therein lies the rub. VCEA's technology-specific mandate was simply not designed to handle Virginia's rapidly evolving energy landscape. No model exists, nor can one be built, that shows Virginia can meet energy demands while complying with VCEA's mandates. I can say that because I've commissioned independent models specifically attempting to prove otherwise. The math simply doesn't work. To meet demand and remain VCA compliant, Virginia would need to cover 230 square miles, roughly 3 to 4 times the size of Washington, D.C., with solar panels by 2035. Even then, we would still fall short during peak demand hours because solar only delivers 25% of its rated capacity over time, while nuclear delivers 93%. In simple terms, a 5-gigawatt solar farm produces about a quarter of the electricity that a 5-gigawatt nuclear plant generates, making the renewable-only path fundamentally impractical. The Virginia LCV has credulously supported VCA from the beginning, but has failed to acknowledge its flaws, opting instead to mischaracterize the governor's attempts to modernize our energy policy. The absurdity is staggering. The same voices complaining about the cost consumers might face due to the governor's vetoes are defending VCEA's rigid ideology that will cost Virginia families $5.5 billion in compliance costs over the next 10 years, beginning with utility bill increases this September. Governor Youngkin considers energy legislation based on two criteria. Does it decrease Virginians' utility bills, and does it make our power grid more reliable? These aren't partisan questions. They're practical guidelines for ensuring energy policies meet the needs of our communities. The governor vetoed legislation that failed these basic tests. What Virginia needs isn't more symbolism, it's substance. We need policies that recognize a simple truth. If we're serious about reducing emissions while meeting growing demand, we must treat nuclear electrons the same as solar and wind electrons. During the 2025 legislative session, the Youngkin administration supported sensible legislation to modernize our energy policy by treating all zero-carbon power sources, including nuclear, the same. These reforms would have addressed the impossibility of meeting demand with renewables alone by including nuclear and other zero-emission technologies in the compliance equation, all at reduced cost to ratepayers. Yet the Democratic legislators killed these common-sense fixes, choosing ideology over affordability and reliability, and forcing $5.5 billion of avoidable costs onto ratepayers. Let me be clear. Clean air, reliability, and affordability are not mutually exclusive goals. We can achieve all three. But doing so requires acknowledging what energy infrastructure is built for in the first place, providing our homes, businesses, and communities with the power they need. What good are emissions reductions if they come at the cost of people being able to afford electricity? What good is an emissions-free electrical grid if Virginians can't count on the lights to turn on? Solar has a place in our energy future, but it is objectively not reliable or powerful enough to meet the most fundamental objectives of our power grid on its own. A recent Gallup poll shows that over 90% of Americans worry about the affordability and availability of electricity. Blinding ourselves with the warm glow of renewable tunnel vision won't help alleviate these concerns. However, added investment in reliable baseload power in the form of nuclear and natural gas will. We can have clean, reliable, and affordable energy, but only if we're honest about what works. The Youngkin administration remains committed to an all-of-the-above approach that actually delivers for Virginians rather than simply checking political boxes. This opinion piece was written by Glenn Davis, the director of the Virginia Department of Energy. The title of his piece today is Youngkin Isn't the One Killing Clean Energy.
The final opinion piece is produced by the Chicago Tribune Editorial Board. The Legacy of Mercy, Compassion. As George Mario Bergoglio prepared to assume the papacy, he chose a new name, Francis. That choice was a tribute to St. Francis of Assisi and set the stage for Pope Francis's entire pontificate, in which he showed ceaseless solidarity with the poor and voiceless, just like his namesake. The pontiff set himself apart from all of his predecessors, as he was the first to go by this new name. Francis died Monday morning at the age of 88. As the head of the Church, Francis' leadership was critical in maintaining the faith's relevance and importance. In a world where people increasingly are less likely to attend church, they still listened attentively to the Pope's message. Among his most remembered quotes is a call for compassion. A little mercy makes the world less cold and more just. Indeed, compassion was one of Francis' core tenets. So was unity. Let us dream, then, as a single human family, as fellow travelers sharing the same flesh, as children of the same earth, which is our common home, each of us bringing the richness of his or her beliefs and convictions, each of us with his or her own voice, brothers and sisters all, he said. Among Francis' favorite passages of Scripture were verses that reflected his deep commitment to mercy, humility, and service, as well as his desire for a Catholic Church that is open, compassionate, and welcoming to everyone, particularly those on the margins of society. These passages also reinforced his vision of a more inclusive and loving church, one that follows the example set by Jesus in the Gospels. He frequently summoned the image of the Good Samaritan parable to remind those of faith that kindness is not reserved only for people who look, think, or act like each other. He also emphasized the godliness of mercy and generosity to the poor and needy in his homilies, referencing verses such as Matthew 25:40, in which Jesus tells his disciples, "Truly I tell you that just as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me." He underscored Jesus' teaching that true greatness is the kingdom of God. It's not measured by power or status, but by humility and service. Francis frequently emphasized the role of leadership in the church as one of service, and he called on the clergy to follow Christ's example by serving others, especially the poor and the marginalized. He called upon all church leaders to become shepherds who smell like their sheep. Francis was known to ride public transportation and interact with ordinary people, and also opted to live in the Domus Sancti Martii, a guest house within Vatican City, instead of the grander papal apartments in the Apostolic Palace. Though he was not partisan, his positions often appealed to progressives, giving moral authority on issues such as inequality, critiques of corrupt capitalism, and the need for all people to be good stewards of the earth. Some critics took issue with what they perceived as the Pope's left-leaning ideologies, calling him the woke Pope. But where partisans often employ elements of faith and Christian values for personal or political gain, the Pope's message was based on his deep faith and biblical principle. Other popes have also seen their leadership in public positions on key global issues often have political ramifications. Pope John Paul II was known for his work opposing authoritarianism, and he played a significant role in ending communism in Poland and other parts of Eastern Europe. With the late Pope's passing, the world now awaits news of who will succeed Francis. And as we wait, let us remember his legacy of mercy and compassion and his desire that we love one another regardless of our differences. And that was an opinion piece from the Chicago Tribune editorial board, A Legacy of Mercy and Compassion. Lindsay?
Moving to page A6 now, Virginians gather to mourn Pope Francis, remembered as a great example of Christian charity. This was written by Andrew Kane, Sean Jones, and Chelsea Jackson, all of the Times-Dispatch. Virginians, from high-ranking clergy to parishioners and politicians, fondly remembered Pope Francis, who died on Monday at 88, as an emblem of humility and compassion, who welcomed the poor and the poor in spirit. On Monday, parishioners from around the Richmond area gathered at the Cathedral of the Sacred Heart for a noon service to celebrate the life and leadership of the first Latin American pope, who led the church for a dozen years. Bishop Barry C. Nesto described Francis as a person who had a simple conversational style, a casual style, like what you might find in a pastor from a local parish. He was very practical in his approach to the expression of life, recognizing the messiness of life around us and being compassionate, sensitive, and caring, Nesto said. Nesto said that the death of a pope during the Easter holiday is as fitting as possible, given that the Catholic community is in the midst of change. Whatever we carry with us that causes us stress, distress, and anxiety, the Lord does accompany us in the midst of that to show us a way through, a path towards light, life, and joy, Nesto said. I think we can always experience that somehow or another, even in the midst of these other things. The bishop said Francis taught us that by listening attentively to one another, we can love as Christ in a fractured and polarized world. The Diocese of Richmond covers about 33,000 square miles of southern Virginia and includes 134 parishes and a total Catholic population of more than 246,000, according to the diocese. Kane, Warner respond to Pope Francis' death. U.S. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, a Catholic, posted on X about meeting the Pope once in Rome and speaking with him in Spanish about the need for all to provide hospitality to refugees. Thank God for his life and service, Kane wrote. Nesto noted that he met the Pope three times, most recently in Rome last October during a pilgrimage made by the parishioners of the Basilica of St. Andrew's, Roanoke, where he thanked Francis for elevating a Virginia church to the status of basilica. Those occasions were more formal, exchanging pleasantries, but Nesto described Pope Francis as a person who engaged attentively in these moments, who made you feel as if you were the only person in the room and always had a kind word. He was someone who brought joy to your heart as you encountered him, Nesto said. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, said in a statement, I join Catholics across the globe in mourning the death of Pope Francis. a tirelessly humble and visionary leader for the church. Regardless of your faith, his legacy of endless compassion, his dedication to peace across the globe, and his tireless championing of the dignity of the poor forged a brighter future and illuminated a more hopeful world. Richmonders mourn Francis. Suzanne Silich, 51, of Powhatan, made the trek to Richmond to attend the Mass for the late Pope. He's the head of the church, and as a Catholic, he sets the tone for how Catholics behave, and I found him to be an exemplar of caring for the poor and embodying St. Augustine's idea that the church was supposed to be a field hospital for sinners, not a hotel for saints, Silich said. I love Pope Francis' message of reconciliation and mercy and to give people grace. I think it's worth coming here to honor a man who tried to live that way and to encourage other people to live that way, and that our world would be a much better place if we gave people a bit of grace, she added. Pope Francis' papacy steered the church in a new direction that stressed more inclusion. He emphasized a Catholic church that took an approach that stressed a more worldwide adoption of the church rather than one centralized in Rome. Notably, he also allowed for priests to bless same-sex couples. Nestote said that Francis's legacy will include many of those facets, a desire to reach out to those who might feel distant or alienated from the church, a love for charity and forgiveness. Matthew Nelson, 33, of Richmond, said, I'm a new Catholic, actually. I came into the church last Easter. Pope Francis was very important to my wife. She and I both loved his heart for the poor and how he genuinely loved everybody who was persecuted and on the margins of society. He's been a great example of Christian charity, and we're very blessed to have him as the Holy Father of the Roman Catholic Church. Influence of the Pontiff on American politics. However moving Pope Francis' words and deeds were, the influence of the Pontiff on American politics has waned significantly in recent years, according to the University of Virginia Center for Politics. The share of American Catholics who say that under certain conditions the Pope is infallible when he speaks on matters of faith and morals has declined to its lowest point, according to a recent survey by the nonpartisan National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. Just 40% said that statement is probably or certainly true in 2022, compared to 56% as recently as 2016. Kyle Kondik, an editor at the Center for Politics at UVA, attributed the shift to conservative Catholics' growing discontent, specifically with Francis' governing style. One possible explanation here is that conservative Catholics reacted to Pope Francis' progressivism on certain matters and thus were less likely to agree with the statement on papal infallibility on issues of morals and faith, Kondik said. Francis, however, continued to closely follow American politics. I have followed closely the major crisis that is taking place in the United States with the initiation of a program of mass deportations, Francis wrote in a letter dated February 10th. The act of deporting people who in many cases have left their own land for reasons of extreme poverty, insecurity, exploitation, persecution, or serious deterioration of the environment damages the dignity of many men and women and of entire families and places them in a state of particular vulnerability and defenselessness. Kondik said that a religious divide among American Christians, especially Catholics and Protestants, was once one of the defining features of American politics. But that is no longer the case, he said. The Catholic faith of John F. Kennedy was hotly debated during his successful 1960 presidential campaign. But Joe Biden's Catholicism was not a major talking point during his 2020 bid. This is also probably means that however important the identity and beliefs of the Pope were in American politics many decades ago, they are most assuredly less important now, he said. Loss of a father figure. Regardless, Richmonders who attended the Mass for Pope Francis at the Cathedral of the Sacred Heart in Richmond on Monday expressed sadness, anxiety, and gratitude. Molly Bergen, 22, of Richmond, said, I was baptized just last year, and it was such a shock to hear that he had died. But I'm so blessed that I was able to be baptized and confirmed and just come into the church during his pontificate. The loss of a pope to the church is like a family losing a father, Bishop Nestote said. That means the upcoming period of transition shows uncertainty about the future direction of the Catholic Church. It causes us to turn inward a little bit, maybe in a deeper way, in faith to trust that God has things well in hand and that he's going to carry things through to where he wants them to be for his people, for all of us. And that article was from page A6, Virginians Gather to Mourn Pope Francis.
An article on page 13 is titled, Most of AmeriCorps Staff Placed on Leave. It's by Hannah Fingerhut and Tran Nguyen of the Associated Press. AmeriCorps placed most staff members on administrative leave with pay last week, effective immediately, according to a staff member, and an internal memo shared with the Associated Press. The memo from AmeriCorps interim director told staff that the administrative leave would remain in effect until future notice. It was sent Wednesday, the day after the agency's National Civilian Community Corps members were informed that they would be discharged from their service terms early. The dismissal of young volunteers came as the Trump administration and the Department of Government Efficiency cuts the government workforce and services. About 15% of the agency's staff remained active, according to an AmeriCorps staff member who provided the internal communications to the AP, on condition of anonymity, as the person was not authorized to do so. AmeriCorps employs more than 500 full-time federal workers and has an operating budget of roughly $1 billion. During the period that you are on administrative leave, you are not to enter AmeriCorps premises, access AmeriCorps systems, or attempt to use your position or authority with AmeriCorps in any way without any prior permission or prior permission of a supervisor in your chain of command, the memo reads. The agency oversees a number of volunteering programs and dispatches 200,000 volunteers across the country to work with school children, veterans, and older adults, among other things, according to its website. AmeriCorps NCCCC, which completed its 30th year last year, employs more than 2,000 people ages 18 to 26, participating for a roughly two-month service term, according to the program's website. A request for a comment was left with AmeriCorps on Friday. On Thursday, California Governor Gavin Newsom said his state would sue to stop the dismantling of the service program. The lawsuit had not yet been filed as of Friday afternoon, and the California Department of Justice would not share details on what grounds it would sue. We've gone from the New Deal, the New Frontier, and the Great Society to a federal government that gives the middle finger to volunteers serving their fellow Americans, the Democratic governor said in a statement. And that was an article from the Associated Press, Most of AmeriCorps Staff Placed on Leave. And with that, Lindsay and I will take a short break and be back with the death notices and other news as time allows. So stay with us, please.